Well, welcome again to Christ the King, Savannah. This summer, we've been working through the Songs of Ascent. Let me scoot over here so I can see some of you guys in the back corner there. The Songs of Ascent, Songs for the Road, your summer road trip album that the gospel provides you. What does it mean? What sort of songs do we sing as pilgrims on the journey to God's presence and the journey to being with Him? This one time, and we come to our last psalm, and I think it's a good psalm to end on, not because it's the last psalm of ascent, but actually because it carries many of the themes from these previous psalms over and over again in it. They come back again, but ultimately this psalm is perfect to end on because it ends where we are now, the sort of experience of the psalmist as he looks for God, as he journeys to Him. Ultimately, that experience is reflected in our own experience right now, an experience ultimately, I think, of tension. The experience of tension. When I was a little kid, my grandpa would pick me up every Wednesday from school. I guess it was elementary school, maybe middle school, early middle school. And every time we got in the car, he would tell me a joke. And he had about four or five jokes that he would run through. And some of you who have heard some of these jokes are terrified that I'm about to tell them up here right now. I'm not. There's only one of them that was appropriate for Sunday or for church. And it went like this. He would look at me over his glasses when I got in the car. And he'd say, and granted, remember, this is like one joke probably a month. This joke gets repeated probably the first Wednesday of every month, say. And he'd look at me and he'd say, "Soren, what's black and white and red all over?" Two impossible things in my little elementary school mind to grasp. How could something be both black and white and red all over? It's killing me. And somehow I could never remember the answer to this riddle. Do you know it right now? Don't tell me if you do know it. It's the end of the sermon. It's the big wraparound illustration. Don't ruin it for all of us, okay? Right? It's black and white and red all over. It would just kill me trying to remember this thing. And my response to the sort of tension I felt, because that's what you feel when two seemingly impossible things have to coexist next to one another. Your brain just, part of what it means to be a human is your brain just wants to resolve it, you know? You want to figure out what is the thing underneath the story or the relationship underneath these two impossible things that both of these seemingly opposite things, these what some would call paradoxes, can exist in the same place. And I had all kind of reactions to this when I could not remember the punchline. Sometimes I would just refuse to play. I would turn to side, "I'm not doing this anymore, Pops. You know, I can't do it." Sometimes I would guess. I would make up my own terrible answers. The only one of those I can remember is a ghost rolling down a hill in a barrel of apples, right? That was how I answered the question. Sometimes I would beg him to tell me, "Pops, please." And he would laugh, because he knew I couldn't remember, and he had me at his mercy, right? Black and white and red all over. That's the tension that these two seemingly impossible things held together, and my brain thirsting for. What is the underlying relationship or explanation that makes sense of both of them at the same time? And I wonder if, for those of you who were here last week, you didn't walk away feeling a tension very similar to that. Remember last week what we said, that in the journey to God on the Songs of Ascent, in the journey to God's presence, when God shows up, this is how you know He shows up. He blesses you in very ordinary ways, in family, in work, in relationships. This is what happens when God shows up. This is the sort of thing that He does. And that's a great message. That's a winner church plant message, right? I want to go to a place like that, you know? This God that we're talking about blesses me in my ordinary life. What could be better? But I wonder if some of you walked out of here going, "Have you seen my life? I follow God. I've been praying. I've been seeking His presence. I long to know Him. And yet, the harsh reality of my ordinary life doesn't really feel like one of blessing. I'll tell you what it feels like. It feels like I'm in the depths. I'm in the depths." And I just wonder, Soren, Reverend Bible, how can I square what you say is true about God with what I feel on a daily basis. Two seemingly impossible things that God, when He shows up, blesses us. And the reality of our lives. How do you reconcile that sort of tension? What sort of answers do you come up with? Well, I think there's a couple popular ones on offer, right? The first is to deny the Bible. You know, to deny the statement that we made last week that when God shows up, He blesses us in ordinary ways. Obviously, religion is the opiate of the masses, and this is something that people tell themselves so that they can help themselves sleep at night. But I'm liberated, and I know better than these old stories, right? And clearly, if God says He shows up and blesses us in ordinary ways, and you look at my life, I will collapse the tension and say, there is no God because He's not showing up. That's one option, right? Perhaps understandable. Perhaps you've been there. I know that I have emotionally at times. The other option, of course, is to deny not the Bible, but to deny the reality that we live in. The reality whereby in our ordinary lives we feel a lot of pain and suffering. This is the sort of Christian who would say that because we're Christians, we have a smile on our face all the time, and that I am fully blessed. And if I can just slap some Jesus language on it, like that second coat of paint back there, all the structural issues in my life will go away, you know? The new coat of paint will fix it. Ignore the fact that there's a rat under the bathroom sink like there was that time, you know? Like, so we collapse the tension in one way or the other. Either God's promises to bless us are not true, or our lives really aren't all that bad. And I think what Psalm 130 does is say this, that instead of denying the Bible or denying reality and living in some Candyland dream world, we should do this. Instead of trying to embrace the tension, or skip the tension, we should embrace it. And we should do that because God at the bottom, the relationship that makes sense of both our suffering and His promise, God under there is good. He's good. He's good to us. And so we seek not to collapse the tension, but to embrace it. What does it mean to embrace the tension? 3 points that this psalm helps us see. What? How do we live a tension-embracing life? I want to say this. We got to cry out. We got to embrace reality. We've got to wait. We've got to embrace God's promise. And lastly, we've got to exhort. We've got to do this together. First, cry out. The psalmist, verse 1 and 2. Out of the depths, I cry to you, O Lord. What are the depths? Well, this sort of language gets used all over the psalm. Sometimes the depths refer to the bottom of the mountain. Not like at sea level, but under that. The roots of the mountain, right? Way under everything, right? Sometimes the language, the depths, refers to the seas, which are a metonym for the chaos of life, right? This sort of dark force which will threaten to overwhelm you. Either way, it's clear that verse 1, the psalmist demonstrates that he gets our reality. He gets it. He understands that though God promises to show up and bless our ordinary lives so often, it is not that way. He feels, and we think it's a he, most scholars think it's David. This psalmist feels like he's being buried alive by life. In a grave somewhere. And he's crying out. Do you know anything about this? This sort of crying out. The old language that we would have talked about, this sort of crying out, would have been to complain. And by that I don't mean whine. I mean take news of the reality of the situation of life. He's complaining in verse 1 and 2. He's sketching out all the ways. Maybe he's thinking in his heart all the way that his life is overwhelming him, that he's being buried alive. You know what being in the depths look like. Sometimes it's a big event. It's a tidal wave that puts you in the depths. You know, this sort of, I don't know if you saw floating around the internet recently, a wave pool in China malfunctioned. And it had been these gentle waves that all these kids and families, and all of a sudden this massive tidal wave comes up and this actually injured like 45 people or so. Never saw it coming, right? And if they'd been at the ocean, if they'd have been at tidal, rip current, drag down to the depths, you know about big events, about tidal waves that just come out of nowhere, crashing on you and making you feel like you're being buried by life. I'm talking about deaths in the family. I'm talking about, ironically, births in the family. I'm talking about divorce, obviously, but I'm also talking about marriage, less obviously. I'm talking about a move or a job loss, these massive events which scientists have sort of calculated as some of the most stressful things that people can experience in an ordinary life, these big events that threaten to bury us alive. Maybe the psalmist is thinking about that, or maybe he's thinking about the slow drizzle, not the tidal wave. Maybe he's thinking about death by a thousand paper cuts, by the chronic stress which threatens to overwhelm us, do or die deadlines, ongoing relational struggle with that family member who just will not change, pressure at work, finances running low, death by a thousand paper cuts, the million little chaoses of life, just too much. Now some of you are going to say, or maybe you want to say, even right now, is it really all that bad? Doesn't Jesus change this experience? Don't we live? That's just an Old Testament thing, right? We have Jesus now. And then you remember Jesus himself, the master whom his students are not above. You know, that moment when they're nailing him to the cross and he cries out the words, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And for one awful moment, God is overwhelmed by the tidal wave of life. Can you complain in this sense to God? Can you embrace the reality that some of you have really difficult lives and really difficult circumstances? And I know, other people have it worse than me. Yeah. Okay, sure. That's true. But like, your experience of your struggle is still real, is still valid. Can you take it to God, or do you use God to whitewash it, to pretend like it isn't there? Well, some of us are good at talking about the difficulties in our circumstances. But others of us, and these are the honest ones, ask another question after we complain with the psalmist. How did I get here? You know, we look at these 1,000 different little paper cuts in our lives and start to recognize that there is a common denominator, a common theme in all of our dysfunctional circumstances and relationships. And you know what the common theme is, right? It's us that we're there. And I'm not saying that you are solely to blame for all the difficult circumstances that you're facing. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is, like, you keep ending up in them, right? And you've heard some like similar things and similar feedback from people. And maybe if you're a particularly honest and courageous person, you're going to look at your life and you're going to say, some of this chaos I can do nothing about. But you know what? Some of it is my fault. Some of it has been a result of me trying to manage and fix other people. Some of it has been a result of me trying to boost my own ego by using other people, and it's biting me in the butt all of a sudden. I've been covering for others or fighting with others. And this is when you realize that verse 3 comes after verse 1 and 2. That not only does the psalmist experience and cry out about his reality, he also confesses his reality. The chaos of life is not just outside you, although it is. It's also inside you. And there's a part of you that bears some culpability. That moment is a weird moment. I took my kids, my two sons, Malcolm and Theo, up to hang out with my dad in the mountains this past weekend. A little father-son, grandfather bonding time. We called it Camp Spacho. That's what they call my dad. And it was awesome, man. It was totally worth it. I'm so glad that I did it. But there was a moment in there where we were taking video of my sons helping my dad out in his garden, you know. And they did something silly while we were videoing this. And I made some remark, some comment, you know. And then I was watching the video back on Facebook the next day. And I heard my voice. as my sons messed up something in the garden, they cut a flower that they weren't supposed to, I heard my voice. And here's what I did. I went, all right. And when I heard that, it sent a chill down my spine. Because you know who it sounded like? It sounded like my dad. Our voices were like impossible. I could not figure out for a second who had said it. And the chill went down my spine because I remember the way that feeling, subtle as it was, of disdain and contempt when I would mess something up. You know, I remember what that felt like as a small boy. Here I am, incontrovertible proof on video, as good a proof as we can get, due certainty, I guess. Like, here I am doing it, you know? Here it is in me. And it's, I think it's what the psalmist realizes in verses 1, 2, and 3. He cries out about his circumstances, yes. He's a victim. But you know what else he is in verse 3? He's a villain. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities. Oh Lord, who could stand? Can you embrace reality? Can you cry it out to God? Can you complain to Him about your circumstances? Can you confess to Him about your sinfulness? I think the reality is this: to say anything else about ourselves, that we have this villainous streak in us, it's reckless. It's naive, or it's posturing for Instagram. And ultimately, if we can't embrace the reality that everybody else can see, we will end up alone, or we will abandon the faith as a dream world. We've got to cry out. We've got to complain. We've got to confess. But here's what I want to say. Maybe this is for the millennials in the room and younger. We sort of get this intuitively. We've been doing this sort of honest, authentic thing for a while. And here's what I want to say. You cannot stop at crying out. You have to do it. You have to be honest about the world. You have to be honest about your experience in the world. If you don't do it, you will be alone. But crying out about the reality of our experience is not enough. Because if that's all we do, ultimately, we'll seek pleasure wherever we can find it, and despair when we don't. Win in hopelessness. What does the psalmist do after verse 3? There's a disjunction there at verse 4. O Lord, who could stand? But this is what I am, but God. This is who you are. In verse 4, he turns to the God that he knows forgives and heals and renews and redeems, all the language that comes in verses 7 and 8. We've got it more specifically than the psalmist has it. That's fair. You know, we don't live in Old Testament times. When we do this, we turn to Jesus. When we grappled honestly with our own brokenness and the brokenness in our circumstances, we can't help but turn to Jesus and receive this sort of forgiveness. We start to see ourselves in characters throughout Scripture. I think Paul in Romans 7, where he says this, I do what I don't want to do, and what I don't want to do is what I keep on doing. Who will deliver me, from this body of death? Wretched man that I am. And then, to Jesus, thanks be to God, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Or we see ourselves on the cross, a man crucified next to Jesus, and one thief mocks, and the other thief, knowing he's guilty, knowing what is in the world and what is in his own heart, looks to Jesus and says, Jesus, please, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And we hear the words pronounced on our sinful selves. Truly, I say to you, today, today, you will be with me in paradise. The psalmist knows what sort of God we have, and he knows that the reality of our broken experience is not the end of the story. No, more. He knows that the chaos within us is not the end of our experience. No. There's more. And once he's got a taste of this forgiveness, this renewal, he's ready to do something else. He's ready to wait on more of it. See, he's got a sense now that Jesus is putting back together the pieces in himself that were broken, that Jesus has started in some way to make him whole, to reorient his experience as to the way that he was made to be and that he will be. And if he knows that, he's gotten a taste. So he waits for it, not just for himself, but for the rest of the cosmos, for the rest of the known world. I read a story in Ireland about the opening of the first Krispy Kreme there, you know? And these people, apparently, I can't even pronounce the town. I would butcher it, so I won't do it. This little town in Ireland gets their first Krispy Kreme, and it's got one of the 24-hour drive-through things, and there's like 600 cars in line waiting for it. Eventually, they've opened Krispy Kremes in countries around the world, thousands of franchises, right? But this little town in Ireland made them shut down the 24-hour drive-through because it was literally creating like a mob scene out there. This little town in Ireland was very happy and proud of what they had done. They had sort of shut down the multinational corporation and made them alter their business model because of their excitement for it. One guy on Twitter said this. He says, "People are standing in line at all hours of night, dead-eyed, waiting on Krispy Kreme donuts. Burn down the world," he says. "What are we coming to?" They interviewed somebody in the line. You know what they said? "Well, he hasn't had any yet." He hasn't had any yet. When you get a taste of the goodness that Jesus offers, you become willing to wait. To wait. You have an expectation that there might be more of that. And the promise of God to bless your ordinary life might actually one day come true. Let me ask this question. What if sin is really just this? What if sin is just going after the right thing at the wrong time or in the wrong way? What if sin is not being willing to wait for it? What if sin is trying to put everything right at the wrong time, trying to be whole yourself, trying to fix everything, trying to secure results, to secure blessings, which ultimately ends up in us saying things like, "Well, the ends justify the means." What if our job isn't to fix everything? What if our job is to be faithful and to wait for Jesus to fix everything? This is not some passive thing, right? I mean, waiting, obeying, trusting, hoping, it takes effort. But I think that's what it means to live in the tension, you know? To on the one hand cry out with the psalmist, 130, about the difficulties of life and the sin within your own heart. And then on the other hand, with the psalmist, to look to Jesus, to look to God's faithfulness and say, "No, you've forgiven me. You are knitting me back together. My suspicion is that you're knitting my communities back together. That you're knitting this city back together. That you're putting the world back together." That is living in the tension between our experiences and the promises of God. And I think there's a natural effect to it. And I'll close with this. There's a natural effect to the sort of person who lives in the tension of God's good promise on the one hand and the experience of our lives on the other. And it's effect that flows out of the psalmist in verses 7 and 8. "O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love." You see what he's done? He's moved from his experience to the person of God and who God is and what he knows about the character of God. Ultimately then out to his community. He looks around and he realizes, "Oh man, I've got to exhort my community to wait with me." It's like he knows he needs the rest of the people of God to wait with him. Gosh, our culture makes it so difficult to wait, right? I was looking for a mini fridge for my little man cave soccer chapel in the backyard that I have. And when I was looking on Amazon to order one, a little thing popped up. I think I clicked on the wrong thing. I think it was just an ad. I don't think we have this in Savannah left. yet, but it was a pretty large mini fridge I was thinking about ordering, and this thing popped up that said, would you like a drone to deliver that to you now? And I was like, what? No, I'm trying to imagine a mini fridge flying to me from Amazon. Like so fast, I'm not ready. I was just thinking about this, Amazon. Like, this is space, you know, like instant, you know, like now your groceries come to you. Y'all, we're going to have to figure out something to do with all the spare time we have waiting around. Gosh, that's like, that is going to be an ethical issue, what you do with your spare time soon, I'm telling you, because we hate to wait. And if we don't do it together, we're not going to wait. And the harsh reality is that the waiting ability of a community is bound up in the way that the people around you can wait on Jesus. Think about that scene in Braveheart. And I get it. Braveheart illustrations are so passe, but they're almost so old that I can use them now. That movie is 25 years old, man. That's crazy. You know that Braveheart illustration where the Scottish peasants are facing English cavalry, and nobody in the Middle Ages stands up to cavalry unless you have cavalry. They don't have cavalry. Scottish peasants don't have cavalry, right? And William Wallace, the hero, shows up, you know? And he's got a plan, you know? They carve out these long sticks and they lay them in the tall grass, right? And the horses, the English horse, come charging. And what do? People run away. Listen, here's our experience. In the charge of life, in the chaos of life, we recognize that some of us in this community and in the Christian community are going to run away. That's been in the news recently. Famous Christians, left and right, leaving the faith and this sort of thing. Side note, I don't, like, people who have time to criticize those folks leaving the faith, like, I don't understand. Sometimes I think the person who's got a blog about people leaving the faith, I'm like, you don't know how close you are to leaving the faith. Man, I'm close enough to leaving the faith sometimes. You know, how could I write a blog about somebody else leaving the faith? You know, I don't have time to look at the other people running away. Instead, here's what I've got. Here's the time that I've got. I've got like, what, 30 of you guys out here? And we're kind of doing what William Wallace says when the horses come, right? He's not saying anything else except this. Hold! Hold! And you can almost feel it, right? The power of the horses coming, and like the camera view, it's like horse cam. It's coming in all fast. And all the peasants are crouched down, you know. And you know if like three or four of them break, then the pikes that they've carved will lose their power and they'll be overrun by the cavalry. It only works if everybody waits together. That's the only way it works. Hold. Hold. Man, that's all I got. That's all I got time to do is tell myself that. Most days, you know, and maybe one or two of you guys. That's why they pay me the big bucks. Hold. We've got to exhort one another to wait together, you know. And I think that means doing what the psalmist has done for us tonight. It doesn't mean slapping a coat of Jesus paint on it and ignoring the structural pain underneath, you know. To help somebody hold sometimes means helping people be honest about the reality of their situation. But sometimes it does mean this. Sometimes it says, friend, I know it's hard. I know your experience is broken. I know you've been victimized. And I know also that sometimes you're not so great yourself. But Jesus is coming. The King is coming. And with Him, there is steadfast love. And a redemption and renewal. And what was torn apart is put back together. We may not experience that emotionally in this life. And that does not change the fact that it is true one single iota. Hold. Hold. So we must cry out about our lives to God. We must wait on Jesus. And we must exhort one another. What's black and white and red all over? Anybody figure it out? What you got?
A newspaper.
I got news for you. Jesus is coming soon. Let's wait on Him. Next week we'll talk, how are we going to do this as a community? As a community of believers in Savannah, what is it going to look like to wait on Jesus together. I hope you'll join us. Let's pray now. Heavenly Father, we ask that you give us the patience to wait, a longing for good things, a feeling of sadness when those good things aren't provided, both to ourselves and to our neighbors. That you give us the strength to wait, that we would wait together. We're going to need your Spirit to make us new. Oh, we've tried. I've tried doing it by myself. I know how much patience I've got naturally. But we're not by ourselves. You're with us. We ask that you would help us know it. You would hold up our hands when they're tired. That you would send one another to bear our burdens. That this city would know that there is a people who's waiting on the coming of the King. It's this we ask in your Son's name and by the power of your Spirit. Amen.